Hello and welcome everybody to the launch of Freedom, especially Sir Bob Geldof, who we are extremely honoured to have as our keynote speaker. Sir Bob will speak first about the crisis facing the world, after which Jeremy will present the answer to that crisis. Now, the most quoted author in Freedom is the great philosopher Laurens van der Post. And in his 1990 RGS Television Lecture of the Year, he anticipated Jeremy's book, Exploration of the Human Condition, with which we're fittingly launching here today, with an honoured fellow of the RGS, Sir Bob Geldof. So before asking Bob to speak, I just want to play you a short extract of Sir Laurens' lecture back here in the other hall in 1990.
People so very often nowadays say to me, you know, the explorers in mankind must be singularly unemployed today, in the physical sense, in the geographical sense. They must be unemployed, but there's nothing left in this world to explore. And well, of course, there is what you mean by exploration. And in a sense to which exploration is both an exploration into the physical and to the spirit of man, there is a lot ahead to do. The future is in your keeping. There is exploration in reverse to do. We must go sharply into reverse. We must rehabilitate ourselves. We must get back to our own natural selves to join with our other conscious, willful, rational, scientific selves. Your job is not over.
I'd like to welcome Sir Bob Geldof.
Thanks, Tim. I've never felt the world more threatening, more fractious, more vociferous, more febrile. And therefore, if there's new thinking or new ideas from a scientist, from a biologist, from a man who's used his life on the, you know, sort of almost quixotic expeditions to find Tasmanian tigers, but to prove they live or don't live, that they exist or they don't exist, to prove it, to be a scientist, then you kind of have to pay attention to a person who thinks about what a genius like van der Post has considered, which influences us and the way we live and the way we think. And therefore we need to think, we need new ideas, we need proselytizers, we need obsessed people, which I think Jeremy is. We need him to be questioned, we need it to be argued, but we need it to be read and talked about and understood. It may be right, it may be wrong, but you need someone as committed to trying to understand what gets us here time after time. We must be better than that. Never before have we needed genius, magic, and power more. And the word I'd add to that is thought and thinking. It is the RGS. You come here to listen to the great thinkers, the great architects, the great scientists. You come here to debate with them or to go out into the London streets alive with ideas. He has the ideas. And he said, are you sure? I said, yeah, get Snape to come out. He's a bloody mountaineer. He's halfway up K2 at the moment. Get him to come down and do this. And you talk to these thinking people. That's why I love the RGS. You talk to these thinking people. They may agree, they may disagree, but you know it. And you'll have set some little spark alight to make them think afresh and think differently. He did it with me. I hope he does it with you right now. Ladies and gentlemen, Jeremy Griffin.
I'd like to acknowledge Sir Laurens van der Post's daughter Lucia, but she's in Botswana, so she's represented by her husband, Neil Crichton Miller. Thanks, Tim, my wonderful, wonderful friend on this long and very difficult journey that's led to this day, for your kind words. Now, my gratitude to Sir Bob Geldof for agreeing to talk at the launch of Freedom is completely bottomless. Because in my view, Sir Bob Your concern for humanity is second to none, and your preparedness to relentlessly point out the horror of our species' plight makes you the conscience of the world. I love your honesty so much that to me it's like the coming of the summer rains that water the parched. No, it's very important. I was thinking this morning, he's like John the Baptist crying in the wilderness, whatever the phrase is.
God,
no, he keeps telling the world, you know, he's like that canary in the mine that tells us that things are desperately out of whack. And that's important. He's a great inspiration, his honesty. And I know he's champion of lots of other things, but that to me is so special. So I'd like to begin by mentioning some of the amazingly honest statements made by Sir Bob. And he says, here we go, but it's very important because it emphasises that we have to solve the human condition, that's the unlocking point for the whole, all of the problems we face. So I'll just read a couple of them. At a conference in Montreal a week or so ago, where is the public good in the vast inequality wrought by modern capitalism, which Sir Bob's just referred to again? And then he said, I never felt greater fear and greater anger than I do today, which he made a similar comment to that. And in, he's already, deep in the heart of nowhere, Alvin, he's saying, what are we going to do because it can't go on? This is the world calling, God help us. And searching through their sacred books for the holy grail of why, but the total sum of knowledge knows no more than you or I.
Forget literature, just buy that album and all the wisdom of the ancients will come to the fore.
There's a lot of truth. If you read Freedom, there's a lot of quotes from songs, and because the truth bubbles up in rhyme and so some amazingly prophetic statements. And in the brilliant Yeats documentary last month, you pleaded for Yeats' revolution of the mind, where peace, pluralism and respect will replace hate and aggression. And at the very end of your book, Geldof in Africa, you said, feed the world, for we are empty of hope and too full of despair and have nothing to nourish our dreams. Basically, you're pleading for the food we really need, which is understanding of the human condition. Now, the real frontier, the ultimate frontier that we have to explore is not outer space, but inner space. As Sir Lawrence Vanderpoel said, we have to, in what you saw on the screen, we have to go sharply in reverse, join our old natural selves with our willful conscious self. Again, the message is we have to solve the human condition, understand ourselves. And as I'll seek to make it clear, unless the reconciling understanding of the human condition was found, as I'm suggesting it now is, in Freedom, the rapidly escalating pain and alienation in humans is going to increase at such a rate and at such an extent that all the suffering humans have experienced to date will be minuscule compared to the amount of human suffering that would occur. And I want to say that there's only one doorway out of that plight, and that is this doorway that I'm going to talk about, which is through this understanding that ameliorates our troubled selves. In Van der Post terms, heals the split between night and day, between our original natural self and our conscious self. It's been 50 years' journey to get to this day and to this venue and this presentation. Now, to begin, Sir Bob, you're a fabulous humanitarian, but as you said just then, that and you said it to me the other day, that the holy grail of why, as you refer to in your song, the human condition exists, is a question that biologists, empiricists, I think you just referred to, like myself, have to answer. Biology is a study of behaviour, and we're interested to make sense of our behaviour, get to know our... You know, in the temples, the ancients had, man, know thyself. Unless we find understanding ourselves, we're in big trouble. That's the unlocking thing. And that's what I'm going to talk about today. I'm going to make sense of us, like you've never heard it made sense of before. And it'll grow and grow on you, this understanding, because it's true and and it's what we need. So it takes time to digest it, but it's incredibly powerful once I can convey the idea, communicate the basic idea. Now, I want to begin by a statement that Bob made, which is, he said, we're not going to turn into people who are all hugging each other, Jeremy, because we're all competitive by nature. The question is, how do we relieve ourselves from our unchangeable primal instincts that are selfish and competitive? That's a principle in biology that all humans have been subscribing to that I now want to tear to shreds. And I want to say that after exposing the lie, that fundamental lie that we're all using to justify our divisive behaviour, I'll then explain that ours is a psychological condition, and a psychosis can be healed with understanding. So Bob, in that moment of deep thinking, said we can't fix ourselves because we're fundamentally, genetically selfish and competitive. And so what are you going to do about that, Jeremy? But I'm going to tackle that head on. We aren't. It's a psychosis. Now, this is very, very interesting stuff I'm going to be showing you. It'll absolutely knock your socks off, some of this stuff. It's certainly true that we have used the excuse that we humans are competitive, aggressive and selfish because we compete for food, shelter, territory and mate like other animals do in order to reproduce our genes. But of course, this can't be the real reason for our competitive and aggressive behaviour, because firstly, we humans have cooperative, loving, moral instincts. The voice or expression within us we recognise as our conscience. And Charles Darwin acknowledged this when he said, the moral sense affords the best and highest distinction between man and the lower animals. And to have an instinctive, altruistic, moral nature as we humans do, our distant ancestors must have been cooperative and loving, not competitive, aggressive, like other animals. And secondly, descriptions of human behaviour, such as egocentric and arrogant, inspired, depressed, deluded, pessimistic, optimistic, artificial, hateful, mean, immoral, guilt-ridden, evil, psychotic, neurotic, alienated, all recognise the involvement of our species' unique, fully conscious thinking mind, that there is a psychological dimension to our behaviour. Humans have suffered not from the genetic opportunism-based, non-psychological animal condition, where they're always trying to reproduce their genes, but the conscious mind-based, psychologically troubled human condition. We don't talk about the animal condition, we talk about the human condition. So saying we have competitive aggressive instincts like other animals is not true. It's just an excuse, but again, an extremely necessary one, as I want to now explain. It's been a very, very necessary excuse that got us out of a horrific situation, which I want to now describe. Now, to start, let's imagine that it is true that our distant ancestors lived cooperatively, lovingly, and the instinctive memory of which is our moral sense. So in following that idea through, let's imagine that Plato was right when, long ago in 360 BC, he wrote, this is 360 years before Christ, he said, our state of innocence, before we had any experiences of evil to come, when we were simple, calm and happy, pure ourselves and not yet enshrined in that living tomb which we carry about now, a time when we lived a blessed and spontaneous life, where neither was there any violence, war or quarrel among us, and we dwelt naked and mostly in the open air, and had no beds but lay on soft couches of grass. This is Plato, 360. And let's imagine that Plato's compatriot Hesiod was right when in his poem, Theogony, he wrote, when gods alike and mortals rose to birth, a golden race the immortals formed on earth. Like gods they live with calm, untroubled mind, free from the toils and anguish of our kind. Strangers to ill, their lives in feasts flowed by. They with abundant goods midst quiet lands, all willing shared the gathering of their hands. And let's imagine that our mythologies were right when, As author Richard Heinberg summarized, every religion begins with a recognition that human consciousness has been separated from its divine, from a divine source, that a former sense of oneness has been lost, that everywhere in religion and myth there is an acknowledgement that we have departed from an original innocence, and that the cause of the fall is described variously as disobedience, as eating of the forbidden fruit in Christianity, the fruit from the tree of knowledge, becoming conscious. That's what they're saying. So we became conscious and the shit hit the fan. Everything seemed to go to hell. And further, let's imagine that it is true that primatological studies of bonobos, which is the variety of chimpanzee living south of the Congo River, are revealing a great deal about how loving, cooperative our distant primate ancestors likely were. Now, these are a couple of quotes here that you'll be absolutely astonished. To evidence this, these are some absolutely amazing descriptions of bonobos. Bonobos are surely the most fascinating animal on the planet. They're the closest animal to man. They're the only animals capable of creating the same gaze as a human. And then this guy goes on, and once I got hit on the head with a branch that had a bonobo on it. I sat down and the bonobo noticed I was in a difficult situation and came and took me by the hand and moved my hair back like they do. So they live on compassion, and that's really interesting to experience. Yes, a bonobo, listen to this. As bonobo keeper Barbara Bell said, adult bonobos demonstrate tremendous compassion for each other. For example, Kitty, the eldest female, is completely blind and hard of hearing. Sometimes she gets lost and confused. They'll just pick her up and take her to where she needs to go. And Bell said, they're extremely intelligent. They understand a couple of hundred words. Working with them is like being with 2.5-year-olds. They love to tease. Like during training, if I were to ask for their left foot, they'll give me their right foot and laugh and laugh and laugh. Researchers have said that bonobos historically have existed in a stable environment rich in sources of food, and unlike chimpanzees, have developed a more cohesive social structure. For example, up to 100 bonobos at a time from several groups spend their night together. That would not be possible with chimpanzees because there'd be brutal fighting between the rival groups. So here's a photo of a bunch of bonobos. Now notice that what's being said is amazingly similar, well, it's absolutely identical to what Plato described long before bonobos were even known of, which was that our distant ancestors dwelt naked and mostly in the open air, and they had no beds and lay on soft couches of grass. There's the soft couches of grass. And in Hesiod's words, they with abundant goods midst quiet lands, all willing shared the gathering of their hands. Bonobos' unlimited capacity for love is apparent in this wonderful first-hand account from a researcher, Vanessa Woods. This is someone who works in the Congo Basin studying bonobos. Bonobo love is like a laser beam. They stop, they stare at you as though they have been waiting their whole lives for you to walk into their jungle. And then they love you with such helpless abandon that you love them back. You have to love them back. And significantly, bonobo society is matriarchal and focused on nurturing their infants, as this quote evidences. Bonobo life is centered around the offspring. Unlike what happens among chimpanzees, all members of the bonobo social group help with infant care and share food with infants. If you're a bonobo infant, you can do no wrong. Bonobo females and their infants form the core of the group. Now, I don't have time to go into it here, but this, the significance of nurturing and how it created our moral instincts and also bonobo's cooperative loving society is explained in Chapter 5 of Freedom. So that's an insight into how amazingly cooperative loving bonobos are. Now, if all these imaginings are right, that our distant ape ancestors lived completely cooperatively and lovingly, and then we became fully conscious and for some reason began to behave competitively, aggressively and selfish, then how absolutely terrible a predicament would that condemnation have been? This is incredibly important. If we did live metaphorically in this Garden of Eden state of cooperative loving innocence. And then we became conscious, and for some reason which we didn't understand, we became incredibly, you know, instead of loving and gentle, we became, developed a propensity for shocking deeds of violence, depravity, indifference and cruelty. For some reason, we had turned into seemingly evil monsters, sufferers of the human condition. So we can now see that it makes complete sense that the guilt from trying to think about and confront the truth of the horror of our corrupted condition has been so great that we could only cope with it by not coping with it, by adopting all manner of dishonest denial and excuses, basically blocking out any thoughts that would about how corrupted we'd become. Plato's famous cave allegory, in which he depicts humans having to hide deep underground in a cave because they couldn't face the truth of the imperfections of human life, is an accurate description of how deeply resigned to living in denial of this issue of the human condition we humans have been. So I just want to go over that again. If we lived a lovely, harmonious, cooperative existence, and then we became conscious, and then we became competitively aggressive and selfish, and we had no understanding explanation for why, how terrible would that have been? How great would the guilt have been? Let's imagine that you lived in a small village, and for some reason you weren't able to explain, you and the whole village agreed that no one was to, you know, plant weeds, but you had to plant your whole place out with thistles. Imagine after, and you can't explain that. Imagine after just 1 week, you know, you go down, no one will talk to you, they put dead cats in your letterbox, and the ostracism, because you can't explain it. You've had to do this seemingly terrible thing, and you can't explain it. How ostracized would you feel in that village after 1 week? Well, try imagining 2 million years of living without the ability to defend yourself, to explain yourself. That's how long we've been fully conscious. And as I suggested, the human condition has existed. You can't imagine a worse torture to have been so loving and cooperative as we've seen suggested what the bonobos are doing, and then have had to become competitive, aggressive and selfish. We would have felt terrible. I might just put this picture of, so that's Plato's cave. So this is a drawing I've done of the human journey from ignorance to enlightenment. And you can see on the left there, we lived in this childhood innocent state in this Garden of Eden in Africa. And then we started to become conscious, and then we became competitive, aggressive and selfish. So we're suddenly faced with having to live a life of incredibly anger, egocentricity, and alienation. And you can see sitting on the ridge there, looking back, you're looking at this magic time and looking forward into this wasteland. And you're still looking at that. Because children, when they're about 12 or 13 or 14, they actually still wrestle with the human condition. They actually can see that. They can see their soul still alive. They can still see that something's terribly wrong. And they can't, and they try to understand that. And adults can't explain it. So they go into themselves and just lock themselves in a room, bang, listen to loud music because they can't make sense of the horror. But one day when they're about mid-15, it's so depressing what they're trying to face down, they give up. Most of us can remember resigning. You get glandular fever and parents can't relate to their kids. That's because they're still trying to face the issue of the human condition. And then, see, because when we were adults, everyone went through that stage, they learned to block it out. But they haven't yet learned to block it out yet. They're still trying to face the issue of the human condition down. And it's so it's so depressing, so suicidally depressing, that they've finally realised that they've got to join the masses and do what everyone else is doing and just forget that dark corner forevermore. It's too depressing an issue to talk about our lost innocence. So, so that's a very important position to understand what we would have done if we believed that we'd turned into monsters and we couldn't explain why. We would have to come up with some excuse. We couldn't just accept that we were monsters. So we desperately needed to come up with something, some way of justifying ourselves. So what excuse was there that we could think of? Well, we looked around and other animals are always fighting and competing and tearing each other's throats out. And so to save ourselves from suicidal depression, we said, well, that's why we're competitive and aggressive. We too have savage animal instincts that compel us to compete for food, shelter, territory, and a mate. Further, we said that the task of our unique conscious mind is to try to control those supposed brutal savage instincts within us. So it was a very clever idea, but completely untrue, because we have cooperative loving past, not a brutal competitive selfish one, as I've just described. Yeah, it was an absolutely brilliant excuse, because instead of our instincts being all loving and thus unbearably condemning of our present non-loving state, they were made out to be vicious and brutal. And instead of our conscious mind being the villain, which caused us to lose the plot, caused our corruption, it was made out to be the blameless mediating hero that had to manage this supposed vicious instincts within us. So instead of our instincts being good, which is in the terms of being cooperative and loving, and our conscious mind being bad, having caused this departure from having killed off this paradoxical state that we'd lived in, our instincts were made out to be bad and our intellect good, which, while enormously relieving, was a complete reverse of the truth lie. Our instincts were loving and our conscious mind was not the hero, it was the villain that had caused this corruption. So it's a very, very seductive idea. And that's what Sir Bob was using when he said, you know, Jeremy, you know, we have innate instincts that we can't change, which are to be competitive and aggressive. Now, just to describe what's happened, if you go to university, what's happened to that idea, which is a huge lie. I mean, it's as I said, it's a complete reverse of the truth lie. So when Darwin came along with his idea of natural selection, this excuse that we have brutish and savage animal instincts was given a biological base by misrepresenting natural selection as being a survival of the fittest process. Natural selection is the process by which some members of a population reproduce more than others in a given environment, and in the first edition of The Origin of Species, Darwin rightfully left it undecided as to whether those individuals that reproduced more could be viewed as winners, as being fitter. However, in later editions, Darwin's associates Herbert Spencer and Alfred Wallace persuaded him to substitute the term natural selection with the term survival of the fittest, which is the excuse most people today use to justify their competitive and selfish and aggressive behaviour. I'm just making sure I'm a winner. So it's a distortion of the basic idea that there is this difference in some species, some individuals reproduce and some don't. But whether that means you're fitter to reproduce is not necessarily true. Now, the problem that merged with this so-called social Darwinism is that it didn't explain instances of selfless cooperation in nature, such as occurs in ant colonies, and it also didn't explain our altruistic moral nature. Now, to solve that problem, the theory of evolutionary psychology or social biology was invented, which said that ants are indirectly, selfishly fostering their own genes by fostering their relatives. In the case of ants, that explanation holds true, but when it was used to explain our moral nature, it was found to be wanting, as the journalist Brian Appleyard pointed out. Biologists still have a gaping hole in an attempt to explain human altruism. If, for instance, I help a blind person across the street, it is plainly unlikely that I'm being prompted to do this because he is a close relative and bears my genes. Now, so we've got to run with it. You've got to keep it in mind. We had this magic time. We had to find some excuse. This one will do. So we latched onto it and wrapped our arms about it. It was saving us from suicidal depression. Someone had to come up and try and fix up that hole in the idea. To solve this problem, the multi-level selection theory was invented, which claimed we have some selfish instincts selected at the individual level, and some selfless instincts selected at the group level. Now, even though this group selection idea has been fully discredited on the grounds that any selflessness that develops is always going to be exploited by cheaters, human condition avoiding biologists, which are basically all biologists, have nevertheless adopted it through acceptance of the multi-level selection theory. So this idea that we are intrinsically, our ancestors were competitive and aggressive, has got a huge head of steam. It's a huge industry built around it. And there's one big problem which Sir Bob referred to, you know, which is that we are selfish because we have selfish instincts excuse, is that it implies that we are intrinsically imperfectible. It implies we can't change our selfish and competitive primal nature because it's instinctive in us. It's in our genes. So you see Bob's comment, you know, Jeremy, we can't change our fundamental nature. How much he's absorbed all this culture of built on this lie that we have selfish heritage and competitive heritage. The whole of biology is now based on this fundamental lie that we are competitive and aggressive like other animals. Libraries are full of this dishonest nonsense. Afraid of being holistic and confronting the human condition, science has instead been mechanistic and reductionist. As my professor at Sydney University, Charles Birch, said, what we've been all taught at university is pretty much a dead end. Because they're all using this lie. Now, you've got to remember, we had to embrace this lie because it was the only thing saving us from suicidal depression. So when adolescents are 14 or so, and you can't relate to them if you're a parent, they're immersed in this horror of trying to make sense. They're trying to face the human condition, and you can't do it without an understanding of it. And they don't buy this bullshit that we have credit, because their soul, their instinctive self, is telling them the world is completely kaput. It's wrong. Everyone should be behaving lovingly. So what has gone wrong? They have discovered, what's it called? Ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. So each generation has to catch up to where the whole of that their species, the human race, is at in its journey. And the human race hasn't found the real explanation, which I'm now going to give you, of why we were competitive and aggressive. So the human race, their children have to catch up. They go through the whole journey that the human race has been on, where they try to understand why we became corrupted, why our magic soul was corrupted. And if you try to face that down without the understanding, you're going to end up suicidally depressed. Everybody has had to adopt this lie, and it's become a huge industry. The whole of university campuses, all the libraries, probably 90% of these books that talk about biology is going to be based on this lie that we are fundamentally aggressive. And it's stark, staring obvious that it's not true, because we've all got a moral conscience. Where do we get that from? It didn't come out of thin air. We had it as lovely as Plato and magic time in this of innocence that we lived in, that the bonobos are still living in, at the present living in. As I now explain, it's fully understandable that we had to invent and then believe in an excuse to cope with our extremely corrupted condition. But it means biology is now festering in a cesspit of human condition avoiding dishonest biological crap, living deep underground in Plato's metaphorical cave of darkness. So Bob was only articulating what everyone has been believing in. So now I'm going to present the fully accountable, truthful explanation of human behaviour, the human condition. So this is the critically important part of my talk. That's just the background. I just want to immerse you all in the lie that we've been living with to cope with the human condition. So clearly what's been needed is is a completely fresh approach that truthfully recognises the association between the emergence of consciousness in humans and the corruption of our original, cooperative, all-loving, instinctive state. You can't build the truth with lies. Someone's got to go off and sit under the banyan thinking tree and start thinking fucking truthfully. Because otherwise, you can't... You go to university, you're taught this fundamental lie, and you're not going to get anywhere. Because all you think is going to come off a false, defensive, insecure, fractured base. So someone has to go off and say, this is crap, I don't buy it, I want to start thinking this about all this in a fresh way. We did live in a lovely cooperative state like the bonobos are. Hesiod and Plato were right. And all our mythologies are right. Every religion begins with recognition that we live from this, separated from this divine source. So someone goes off and stops, and this is what I did, and thinks deeply about this, truthfully. Now, when you do that, it's taken the fully accountable, true explanation of our competitive, selfish and aggressive behaviour is reasonably obvious, because it makes sense that when our species became fully conscious, a battle must have broken out between it and our already established instinctive self, our soul. Now, even if we put aside the fact that we have cooperative loving instincts and just look at the fundamental situation an animal species would face if it developed a fully conscious mind, the presence of already established instinctive orientations, we can see how there would have had to occur a psychologically upsetting conflict between the already established instinctive orientations and the newly emerged self-adjusting conscious mind. Now, in this booklet, there's a chart which has these pictures in it. Adam Stork's story, which I'm now going to talk about to explain how the real reason we became competitive aggressive. So you can be given a copy of that when you leave. You can take a complimentary copy of the book, and inside it will be a copy of the full presentation and that chart. Now, to visualise this fundamental situation where consciousness emerges in an instinct-controlled animal, imagine what would happen if we placed a fully conscious brain on a stork migrating from Africa to Europe to breed. Now, this is very simple. We want to see what happens if you put a conscious head on something. It's perfectly instinct. Storks, for thousands of years of natural selection, have learnt where to fly and where not to fly up the coast of Africa. But they don't understand anything. They've got no understanding. So we want to see the whole human condition. Why you've got lovely jewellery and hairs long, everything about us. So we're going to hop in an ultralight and fly along behind this stork. We've grabbed and grafted a fully conscious brain on the top of its head. And we want to see what happens. We want to see the whole human condition emerge. So we're following this stork right now. This is the first day he's had a fully conscious mind. So what's he going to start doing? He's going to start thinking. So he looks down, he sees an island with some apple trees on it. So he goes, I'll go down and have a feed of apples. Why not? He's got no knowledge at this stage. So he duly heads off course from the migratory flight path towards the island. Now what's going to happen? His instincts are going to try to pull him back on course. In effect, condemn his search for knowledge. So you can imagine the first thing, they call him Adam. First thing Adam Stork does, and he gets condemned by his instincts for challenging them, is to give in to them and fly back on course. But then he can't, he's got to persevere with his search for knowledge. He can't cut his brain away and throw it away. He's a thinking being now. So he comes up with another thought. Well, I think I'll go down that island there and have a rest or something. And again, his instincts can criticise him for flying off course. Now this time, he says, listen, mate, I can't explain to you what the hell's going on in me, but I need to carry out these experiments in self-adjustment. And So he defies those instinctive orientations. Now, at this point, I want to put up this chart. So now, this is a little picture graph of old Adam Stork. I asked when we became conscious. So Adam has been flying up the coast. He's got a fully conscious mind. He starts experiment in understanding, because he's now a thinking being. He's carrying out the experiments in self-adjustment, and his instincts try to pull him back on course. Now, ideally, at this moment, he would sit down with his instincts and have a serious talk to them. So here we've got conscious Adam talking to instinctive self, and he's having a yarn to it. He would explain what's going on. He would say, listen, mate, I am now using my conscious mind. I'm a self-adjusting system. You absolutely know where we should and shouldn't fly, but you don't understand anything. And our innocent stork over there would have said, oh, shit, I'm sorry for criticising you. But this is day one of the search for knowledge. He's got no knowledge. He's got no ability to explain anything. He's in a catch-22. He needs the understanding he's setting out to find to explain the human condition to defend his actions. So he can't explain himself. So that little dialogue there can't take place. That little dialogue is taking place right now after 2 million years here in this book. And that's the only dialogue that can stop all the suffering that Bob is so concerned about. We have to be able to explain why we are who we are, why the human condition emerged. We have to find the dignifying, redeeming, healing, reconciling understanding of ourself, of the dark side of ourself. But that's ideally what old Adam Stork would have done. He would have said, look, this is going to get right out of hand, you instincts, criticising me. Sit down there and I'll explain it to you. And he would explain that, you know, the whole basis of the conscious mind. He would say, listen, consciousness, nerves were originally developed for the coordination of movement in animals, but once developed, their ability to store impressions that we refer to as memory gave rise to the potential to develop understanding of cause and effect. If you can remember past events, you can compare them with current events and identify regularly occurring experiences. This knowledge of or insight into what has commonly occurred in the past enables you to predict what is likely to happen in the future and to adjust your behavior accordingly. Once insights into the nature of change are put into effect, the self-modified behavior starts to provide feedback, refining the insights further, predictions are compared with outcomes and so on, much developed. And that's what happened in our mind when we became conscious. And such refinement occurs in the human brain. Nerves can sufficiently associate information. This is called the association cortex, this big lump. Associate information, make sense of it, to reason how experiences are related, learn to understand and become conscious or aware or intelligent about the relationship between events that occur through time. Thus, consciousness means being sufficiently aware of how our experiences are related to attempt to manage change from a basis of understanding. So that's what Adam Stork needed to be able to do in that little dialogue. Explain to that he's using a conscious mind that can understand cause and effect, and the instinctive orientations are acquired through natural selection. Natural selection works over thousands of generations. Some storks tried to fly across the Sahara or got frizzled. Some flew out to sea and perished. Only those storks that happened to have a genetic makeup that was perfectly orientated to flying around the coast of Africa survived. So storks have got this perfect instinctive orientation to where to fly. But an orientation is not an understanding. So, but that's a lot to explain. It's taken the development of science to be able to explain that. Yeah, the problem is Adam's only just setting out the knowledge. He's got no knowledge. Now, so what's he going to do? His instincts are saying, Adam, you're bad. You've flown, of course, you're bad. And he can't stop thinking. He has to keep searching. He has to keep experimenting in self-management. So what would happen? Three things unavoidably happened. Adam Stork says, listen, mate, I don't want to listen to your criticism anymore. I don't deserve it. I can't explain why I don't deserve it, but I'm good, not bad. Get off my case. And he would have got angry. He said, listen, mate, stop giving me the shits. I don't know why I'm good, but I am good, and I'm not going to wear your criticism. So he starts to get angry. And then he becomes egocentric. He starts to block. Ego in the dictionary means conscious thinking self. That's another word for consciousness. So we became egocentric. Consciousness became, we became focused on trying to validate ourselves all the time. We became egocentric. The conscious mind was now condemned and insecure, and so forever trying to validate itself. So since ego is conscious thinking self, Adam becomes egocentric. His conscious mind becomes centered on trying to validate itself through achieving as much compensatory power, fame, fortune, and glory as he can. Yes, materialism and the capitalism needed to supply that. The sparkling chandeliers and big houses, etc., gave Adam the fanfare and glory that he knew he was due, but which the world in its ignorance would not give him. Adam unavoidably became a psychologically upset sufferer of anger, alienation, and egocentricity, because blocking out is alienation, that's anger, and egocentricity, trying to validate himself. So he becomes sufferer of the human condition, which are all the aspects of the human condition that we fully conscious humans become. Now, this story is very similar to the pre-scientific biblical account of Adam and Eve taking the fruit from the tree of knowledge, becoming conscious. Okay? But this account has a completely different outcome. While Adam and Eve were banished from the Garden of Eden for having become sinful, selfish, competitive, and aggressive villains, this story explains that Adam and Eve were, we humans, listen to this, are actually the heroes of the story of life on earth. This is because the conscious mind must surely be nature's greatest invention, and since we were the species given the upsetting task of championing the intellect over the ignorant, unjust condemnation of instincts, we have to be the heroes of the story of life on earth. If we have endured all that injustice for 2 million years, as I said, imagine you planted thistles and you, the ostracism you'd experience, and if you can't defend yourself, that's just 1 week. Try imagining 2 million years of living unjustly condemned on this planet. How heroic are we as a species? Massively heroic. We are the heroes of the story. And what a turnaround is that? Suddenly we were villains. You see, the thing is, Moses, what, 3,500 years ago, wrote the story of Adam and Eve in Genesis. He wasn't able to explain. All you can, if you haven't got science, the ability to explain the difference between nerves and genes, you can't explain, you can't get out of jail. You can't redeem yourself. You just keep coming to the conclusion that you must be bad, evil, because you've corrupted this magic part of yourself. Your conscious mind is evil. And that's what Adam and Eve's story does. It says, they took the fruit from the tree of knowledge, because it was desirable for gaining wisdom, i.e. they became conscious, and then they became, then they were banished because they were evil. But they weren't. And now science can allow us to explain that they were actually the heroes of the story of life on earth. And of course, you know, this is the fundamental situation that any animal species would encounter if they developed a fully conscious mind. We have to consider how much worse the situation was for us, since our instinctive orientation wasn't to a flight path, but to behaving utterly cooperative and loving. In our case, when humans began experimenting and understanding in our distant ancestors and were criticized by our instincts and unavoidably responded in an angry, eccentric and alienated way, we had to endure a further round of criticism, a second hit, a double whammy. From our instinctive origin, yes, in our necessary search for understanding, we were firstly unjustly condemned for defying our instincts, and then again for reacting to that condemnation in a way that was counter and offensive to our instincts. Because our instincts were loving, they weren't to a flight path, they were to be loving and cooperative. So the moment we start to get angry and defensive and egocentric, that's going to produce even more criticism. Horrific. So it's a diabolical situation. And you only have to immerse yourself in what children are going through at resignation. And you will see what, because they're still looking at it cleanly. They still haven't blocked anything out. They haven't adopted the bullshit, the denial, the cope. They haven't adopted this excuse that we have competitive and aggressive past. And honestly, parents cannot relate to them. They can't reach them. They're just sitting there in their head in their room because they're wrestling with it. They can see that this is wrong. We've turned into monsters for some reason and they don't understand why. And eventually they learn they've got to give up trying to think about it. They get so depressed. And then they become part of the adult world where everyone's running with this lie that we're all competitive and aggressive because we have a savage animal instincts, which is just bullshit. But they grab that excuse with both arms because by then they're so fearfully depressed about trying to be honest that that saves their bloody life. So then they're part of the whole problem. They're wheeling this bloody lie around everywhere they go. So we humans had no choice but to persevere with our search for knowledge and suffer the psychologically upset state of being angry, alienated, and egocentric until we could develop the scientific method and through that vehicle for inquiry find the redeeming explanation of our upset condition, of the difference between genes and nerves and the way they process information, which is the key insight that reveals we humans are good and not bad. I can tell you that Moses, 3,500 years ago, is a very honest thinker, extraordinarily truthful thinker. And he's like a 13, 14-year-old, still living with the truth and able to express it in that sort of way. But he can't, every time he thought about it and described it, we just come out bad again. We were bloody innocent and loving and cooperative, and now we've turned into brutally competitive and aggressive. Something's gone really wrong. So children finally give up and just adopt the lie like everybody else, and then they're part of the problem because they're walking around with this bullshit in their head, and you can't think truthfully once you adopt that lie. Yes, until science made it possible to explain the difference, so Moses could get nowhere. If he could talk, if he could articulate his situation, he would say, "I'm stuffed. No amount of clear thinking can get me out of here. Can I redeem humans? Because I can't, every time I think about it, we come out bad." We had to stop, collect knowledge and build up bits of count frogs' eggs, gradually build up enough knowledge to one day be able to explain the riddle of the human condition. We had to discover the double helix and how genes work. And then we had to discover how the brain is built on these nerves based on memory and how memory can become conscious, insightful. That's the knowledge that we had to accumulate that made this liberation from our condition possible. Moses couldn't do anything about it. We had to stop, settle down, build up a knowledge base that might make liberation and redeeming understanding possible. And that's what science did with the nerves and gene-based learning system, understanding the difference. Suddenly we had the means to redeem ourselves. But the problem is everyone's so committed to living with this denial. They all hit 14 or 15, they get horrifically depressed trying to confront the human condition, and then they adopt the bullshit explanation because that's the only way everyone else is doing it, and then you're part of the problem. The reason I've been able to work this out is because I didn't resign. And so I still think truthfully. Anyway, until science made it possible to explain the difference between the gene-based and natural selection process that gives species orientations and the nerve-based conscious mind that needs to understand, every time we tried to think about our corrupted condition, the only conclusion we could come to was that we conscious humans had willfully destroyed paradise. So science is the liberator, the messiah of humanity from the agony of the human condition. It makes clarification of our condition possible. Yep. So there was a good reason why we became corrupted. We had to search for knowledge, ultimately sufficient knowledge to explain the human condition. And there was no way out of our psychologically upset condition until we found that redeeming knowledge. Searching for knowledge made us angry, egocentric, and alienated, but that was the price we had to be prepared to pay. At any time, we could stop our upsetting search for knowledge, fly back on course, in the Adam Stork analogy, and that would make us feel good, stop the criticism from our instincts. But that was an abandonment of our fundamental responsibility, which was to keep on searching for knowledge and suffer all the upset that resulted from doing that until we found the knowledge we needed, which is understanding of the human condition. So of the twin political problems we have in the world today, of the brutality of our freedom from condemning idealism to continue the corrupting search for knowledge right wing, and the pseudo-idealism of the left wing, where everyone just fly back on course and be good, it was actually the corrupting right wing that held the moral high ground, not the left wing as everyone has been imagining. Such is the great paradox of the human condition, that we can now finally understand that truth was not as it appeared. Corrupting Adam Stork, the right wing, are heroes, not villains. Yes, as it says about the great paradox of the human condition in the musical The Man of La Mancha, we humans had to be prepared to march into hell for a heavenly cause. So this first diagram shows Adam Stork, and you see here it's got all the aspects of the intellect: evil, guilty, corrupted, moral, selfish, aggressive, competitive, divisive, ungodly, egotistical, realism, conscious, reason, mind, I think, head, wisdom, science, mechanism, right wing, capitalism, materialism, old men, white, artificial, alienated, dishonest, insecure, troubled. They're all bad, so they're in black. And this guy who's following the instincts, good, innocent, the corollary of this, innocent, pure, moral, selfless, loving, cooperative, integrative, godly, altruistic, idealism, conscience, emotion, soul, I feel, heart, ignorance, religion, holism, left wing, socialism, spiritualism, young woman, man, blacks, natural, sound, honest, secure, happy, country, non-sexual, yin, yang, light. They're all good. They're all part of our instinct side of the equation. But now we can understand that this guy's actually the hero of the story of life on Earth. So the whole equation's flipped. Suddenly this side of it, he's the goody, and this guy's the baddie. All these aspects of ourselves, left-wing, socialism, spiritualism, they all just want us to give in searching for knowledge because it's becoming too corrupting and fly back on course, obey our instincts, being cooperative. But that was actually irresponsible. With understanding of our condition now found, the tables are turned. In fact, our self-adjusting conscious mind turns out to be the hero. This side of ourself turns out to be the hero. As Bono said the other day, truthfulness, when it arrives, will blow things apart. It'll just flip it all. Suddenly, it'll change the whole equation. Carl Jung: wholeness for humans depends on the ability to own their own shadow, to be able to make sense of this side of it, understand it. Sympathy for the Devil, the Rolling Stones. Sir Lawrence Vanderpost: true love is love of the difficult and unlovable. We've got to understand this. To end the oppression of this, to get the foot off the throat of humanity, which has been condemned because it's supposedly divisive and evil and destructive. Finally, we can dignify this person. So actually, this situation where it suddenly flipped around, the tables are turned, and they're the baddies and they're the goodies, doesn't actually happen, because once we're reconciled, neither side, it's all over. This whole dialectic goes. So it only lasts a second to realise that this is the real situation, that both sides are now reconciled, can understand each other. Those two storks that were sitting trying to explain itself, that's now happened. The dark side of ourself can explain to the light side of ourselves why this all happened. Best of all, our ability now to explain and understand that we humans are actually good and not bad enables all the upset that resulted from being unable to explain the source of our divisive condition to subside and disappear. Finding understanding of the human condition is what rehabilitates and transforms the human race from its psychologically upset state. In fact, the word psychiatry literally means soul healing, derived it is from the word psych, meaning soul, and atria, which means healing. But we have never before been able to heal our soul, truthfully explain to our original instinctive self or soul that our fully conscious thinking self is good and not bad, and by so doing reconcile and heal our split selves. Join our old natural selves with our willful conscious self, as Sir Lawrence van der Post said we had to do. As Professor Prosen says in his introduction to Freedom about the psychological effect of this reconciling understanding of ourselves, I have no doubt this biological explanation of the human condition is the holy grail of insight we have sought for the psychological rehabilitation of the human race. Yes, as I've said, Carl Jung said, wholeness for humans depends on the ability to own our own shadow, to make sense of that side of ourselves. Now, most importantly, while it will take a number of generations for all that upset to be completely psychologically healed, because the more you digest this, the more it unravels the underlying confusion. You've got to remember, when you resigned at 15, gave up trying to face the truth and became an escapist, materialist, and adopted the bullshit explanation that we have savage instincts, it's a long way to work your way back from that, to go back and renegotiate your original decision. You're very trained in that escapist way of thinking. But if you give this to unresigned adolescents, they just guzzle it because they can finally make sense of what they're looking at. Because they can see the human condition. They can see it's all wrong. Something's gone crazy. For adults, they have to go back and rethink it, and it's quite a long journey, and so it takes some time. But this is important. While it will take a number of generations for all that upset to be completely psychologically healed through digestion of it, with this clarifying understanding of our fundamental goodness, all our psychologically defensive, angry, alienated, egocentric behaviours is immediately made redundant. As I explained in Chapter 9 of Freedom, with the great burden of guilt lifted from the human race, the old insecure, upset life that went with it is finally over, which means we can all leave that way of behaving behind as finished with, change from living competitively to living cooperatively, which is the great change in behaviour that Sir Bob dreamed of in those quotes I mentioned earlier. You know, he quoted W. Yeats as saying, you know, that we need to change from to living competitively to living cooperatively. And this is how it is actually achieved. So as Sir Bob's fellow rock star Bono anticipated in his songs, everyone will now be able to feel the sunlight of liberating understanding on my face, see the dust clouds, which is all our upset behaviour, disappear without a trace. We will be able to take shelter from the poison rain high on a desert plain in a wonderful egoless new world where the streets have no name, there's no ego. A place where there will be no toil or sorrow, no time of pain, and everyone will sing, I've conquered my past, the future is here at last. I stand at the entrance to a new world I can see, the ruins to the right of me will soon have lost sight of me. Love, in its purest form, which is truth, rescued me. So now we can make sense of all our mythology. The tables are turned, but it's now all reconciled. So the real end result of this is that we're dancing in the street. There's this reconciling understanding. Now, I need to warn everybody that that when the blinds are finally drawn on the human condition, the light inevitably reveals a universe of previously denied truths, a litany of heresies. In fact, the arrival of understanding the human condition brings about Honesty Day or Truth Day or Exposure Day or Transparency Day or Revelation Day, so-called Judgment Day. But as I've explained, it's a day of compassion and understanding, not of cruel judgment. So the following are some of the heresies we have to adjust to. That the human race has been an alienated wreck, the dishonest human condition avoiding mechanistic science has been leading humanity to terminal alienation, that humans have a cooperative, loving, instinctive heritage, not a brutish and savage one, that nurturing was the prime mover in human development and is still critically important, that sex as we humans now practice it is not about trying to reproduce our genes, but rather it is psychologically upset behaviour where we resentfully attack innocence for its seeming criticism of our lack of innocence. That there is a difference in alienation between races, that women are not mainframed to the battle of the human condition in the same way men are, because with women naturally preoccupied with the task of nurturing, the upsetting battle of searching for knowledge had especially to be taken up by men, and with that battle now finally won, what is revealed is that men particularly are the heroes of the story of life on earth. Men are now explained and redeemed, especially, but women also, the whole of the, any human is, that the individualistic and materialistic right wing were actually the ones holding the moral high ground, and the pseudo-idealistic dogma of the left wing has been subverting the human journey. And as explained in chapter 4, that God is the physical law of negative entropy, we can demystify religion. And Christ is not a deity, but a human like everyone else, only sufficiently loved in his infancy not to have resigned to a life of denial. He's just a truthful thinker. So again, the truth is not as it appears, as depicted in the second Adam stalk diagram of the leaflet. Our previously condemning intellect and all its manifestations turn out to be good, that's in gold, and not bad, while the instinctive state and all its manifestation turns out to have been unjustly condemning of humanity's heroic search for knowledge. This turning of tables will be an immense shock, as Bono said. Truthfulness will blow things apart. As George Bernard Shaw said, all great truths begin as blasphemies, as Tim mentioned, because it's such a turnaround of the situation. However, this blasphemy stage, when all the previously denied truths are suddenly revealed, won't last long once the wonderful liberating potential of these understandings that's described in chapter 9 catches on. So now we really have the dancing in the street that Sir Bob didn't believe was possible when he was using the now obsolete and dishonest biological way of thinking about human behaviour. He said, you can't get everyone hugging each other generally because we have intrinsically divisive, selfish instincts, competitive instincts. There's no recognition that it's a psychological state. It is a psychological state, and psychological states can be healed, and that's what will happen once we get these ideas out there. But there's a huge resistance stage because it is a blasphemy. All this, the universities are built on this huge, dishonest castle of lies. So we're going to end now with Dancing in the Street by Martha and the Vandellas.